Happy Valentine's Day. Sweet to have a holiday organized around romantic love. Whether it was invented by Hallmark or not, I don't know. It doesn't matter. In the Buddhist system, in the yoga systems, actually, I'll do a long parenthetical phrase in the middle of that sentence, and I'll say it was really amazing for me sometime in maybe college or kind of late high school when I was taught that kind of some information about the sort of the late Renaissance, the late medieval period, the early Renaissance, and about the beginnings of romantic love. There was a whole movement in Europe around kind of the French storytellers, song singers, the troubadours, the jongleurs, who were going around singing songs about kind of chivalry and the sort of making myths about the possible relationship between men and women. So just to say in a heteronormative myths, Christian normative myths about the wonderfulness of individual, personal, romantic connection. And some of these stories made their way into my aesthetic world as a classical music geek, and I turned into an opera geek, and I liked things like Tristan and Isolde, which is an opera by Wagner, that starts with a gorgeous ascending minor sixth in the cellos and goes on to not resolve back into its home key of A minor for five tormented hours of love and death and loss until it finally resolves. And that's the story of Tristan and Isolde is one of those stories that, you know, becomes kind of what we think of as romantic love. Somebody travels to another place to do an errand. He's bringing a princess back to his king. This is a warrior who's in the service of a king, goes to from England to Ireland to get this princess to bring her back for the king to marry. On their way, they fall in love partly because of a magical potion, and there's witches, and there's a sea voyage, and there's a beautiful love song. And in the end, the king finds out that they are actually in love and does the generous, selfless thing of allowing them to be together, but they die in the end anyway. That's the short version of the five-hour-long, unresolved A minor progression. And that this thing that I thought of as like intrinsic to human existence, like romance, the search for a partner, the desire to fall in love and woo and be wooed and be in the particular thrill of person-to-person sensual longing, that in a certain way was a cultural invention, and that not all cultures do it, and certainly not all cultures do it in the same way. And that was shocking to me when I first kind of got that message. And then it was liberating in another way. And then I became the sort of romantic, non-romantic geek who, you know, would bring flowers to somebody hoping that they would like me too, but then who would footnote the flowers with a small speech about the constructed nature of you know, romantic gestures and how ultimately they're not biologically necessary for the continuation of the species. But here I am anyway, standing at your door, you know, with a boombox over my head or something. You know. And partly why I begin with that is to reflect on the absence of romantic love in, for instance, the early kind of Buddhist and Hindu yogic materials, the texts and teachings that are the backbone of this practice of it focus mindfulness, heartfulness, universal love, which I talked about a bit last week, and liberating the heart-mind from clinging from suffering. So why are they absent, I would ask. And looking at the early texts, you know, one might discern even a kind of anti-romantic sentiment. Right? The Buddha will say, what causes pain, people? Attachment. If there's something that you want and it's pleasurable, you'll suffer because you inevitably can't sustain it. Right? If you fall in love with someone and you get together, at some point they'll die, or you'll die, or you'll separate. All of that is painful. If you get what you want, you'll lose it. And it can seem a little bit like a downer, like, hi, welcome to Buddhism. Everything is loss. In other ways, it's a kind of cool realism, like, hey, guess what? That's true. You can pay attention to it or not. You can focus on the bliss and the beauty of the story, or you can notice the loss. I think one of the things that was great about the operas was they weren't subtle about that, you know. Tosca's in love with the artist painter, but the evil cardinal Scarpia wants her. She stabs him, then they come for her. She's not going to get the painter. He's coming to find her so they maybe could be together, but he only sees the flutter of her dress as she falls off the, leaps off the roof of the cathedral into the Tiber River to die as the soldiers come. And, you know, or in La Bohème, the lovers who are these wonderful artists, they're starving, but they're dramatic, they're hipsters, they fall in love, but then she gets tuberculosis and dies in his arms. Or in Porgy and Bess, where the poor wheelchair-bound Porgy falls in love with this kind of unattainable beauty, Bess, who is owned, as it were, by the pimp, the town pimp. And she falls in love with him. They have a beautiful getting together. But then the pimp and his wiles work on her in the end, and he spirits her away to New York City, the big, distant city. And the closing scene of the opera is Porgy in his cart saying, which way is New York? I'll find her. And just wheeling himself toward the great city to find his love. And like, the great love stories know that loss is embedded in the kind of attachment that romantic love is. They're not good stories otherwise, right? It's a very boring love story that goes, two beautiful, well-adjusted people met each other in a peaceful, non-dramatic way through the influence of a well-meaning friend. They fell in love, had a lot of nice adventures that weren't very dangerous, got married, lived the rest of their lives together with relative lack of conflict, and died together peacefully, without fear. Yay! This will happen to you. You will be the exception, right? So part of what the Buddha might say is a recipe for suffering is that we might pretend that we're doing that story when actually we're doing, hopefully not, Tosca, or, you know. But at the very least, we're doing ordinary life, where you fall in love and then someone dies, or you fall in love and then someone else falls out of love, or you fall out of love, right? It changes. So the focus for liberation in the early teachings was on seeing through the constrictions of attachment. And in that way, the love that's emphasized is an impersonal love or a universal love, a love without the conditions of attachment. What is love between two people if there's not attachment? It becomes a kind of generosity of spirit, a kind of giving without the expectation of return. And so one of the invitations, perhaps, if we try to bring our practice of letting go of attachment into the beautiful practice of celebrating love, which even if I told you not to, you're going to keep doing, and I do too. So there, that's what we're doing. As practitioners, we have this amazing challenge then to recognize that in a partnership or the longing for partnership, and maybe particularly in the longing for partnership, because there's a because the whole force is the force of desire, that in that there is suffering built into it, but there's also a beauty, a deep aliveness in it that we can feel and taste and live into even as we work on the attachment piece. And this becomes subtle. How do you long for a partner but rest in the kind of equanimity that one might come or not? How do you deepen in a partnership or a marriage or a lovership for years and years? And still work on, you know, being more and more at peace with the reality of losing that which we have found. Finding out that your person isn't quite as shining as they looked as you swiped right. And so our practice becomes this kind of paradoxical, but in its way, very sweet dance, where we're not actually, and you don't look like anyway, because you're not in monastic clothing, we're not formal renunciates who have said, I am giving up the world of romance, the world of money, sex, business, children, in order to pursue absolute letting go in a deep way forever. We're householders, and the practice for householders is to live the householder life, to be engaged, if we want to, with money, with sexuality, with children, with business. And that inevitably means some attachment, some connection. In the earliest Buddhist systems, it's said that if, as householders, if we get sufficiently liberated that we no longer crave partnership and wealth and kind of safety or sustenance to a certain degree, a very deep degree. Technically, this is the third level of realization called non-returner, for those of you studying. It's said that if a layperson attains that degree of enlightenment, it's not even full enlightenment, but it's close, they generally immediately ask for admission into the community of monks and nuns because they've lost the force of wanting necessary to stay in the householder life. In other words, you have to want some amount of wealth and contact with people to do this. You have to want something in order to keep working. If you get enlightened to the point that you've let go profoundly, the desire to, you know, to keep churning the wheels of commerce kind of slips away. I was in a long meditation retreat once, and there was an evening where there was a question and answer period for experienced practitioners. All the beginners were out doing something else. And those of us left got to ask the teachers some more sort of intimate questions. And one of the students asked, like, what's your liberation like? What have you become free of? And they described it in different ways, some more compelling than others. And it was a really interesting conversation. One of them, a woman who was maybe in her mid-50s at the time, who had been, who wasn't partnered, who had had partners in the past, wasn't currently partnered. She said, you know, I want to tell you something. I don't really say to students much, because it's not very inspiring, and some of you won't come back if I say this. But I have actually lost the desire for men. I've lost the desire to make contact in a sensual way or a relationship way with this class of people that at one point in my life I was drawn to. She basically was like, I'm over it. And it feels great. Right? You might Some of you might feel like you're over it, whatever your flavor of longing being is. You have to distinguish being over it. It might be that you're liberated from it, and it might be that you're just kind of grumpy about the situation. You're like, please. But she was describing something that in a sense, is a very, very classical liberation. Liberation from the desire that's brought about by sexuality, procreation, romantic connection, or interpersonal connection. And this was the hinge of the whole early renunciate practice, was leaving the world of sexuality. So renunciate is practically synonymous in the early texts with celibate. And so to say that your practice might lead to you no longer wanting sex and partnership, or that might feel good, might cause some of you who just arrived tonight, hi, good to see you, to not come back. Please do come back if you want to. Your practice will not destroy your sex drive, you know, or your but you might want to, we all might want to, practice taking off the rose-colored glasses of the story of romance sometimes, and seeing relationship and connection as a practice, meaning not being in denial about its realities, not being in a kind of hypnosis about its blisses. I think if we do this well, and this is partly my practice as a married person, the connection part becomes more real, feels more real, when I'm not pretending it's something else. And it's also just real that if you're with someone for a lot of years, for me it's about a dozen right now with my person, it has ups and downs that are the kinds of ups and downs that don't even make it into the opera. Right? It's not that one of us cheated on the other and then murdered somebody and then we were on the run from the police and then we sort of got together for a moment before one of us was dragged. You know, like, that's fun. You know, maybe. But the ups and downs are much more like, you know, reality. Right? Like, oh, I haven't been happy for a while. Oh, I'm so sorry. What's going on? You've changed, I've changed, this is changing. What do we do now? And it's good if both folks in the relationship, or all the folks in the relationship, to be poly-inclusive, to be all family systems style inclusive, have something of a compatible practice in relation to how we deal with the fluctuating nature of relationship. Right? If one person is practicing a kind of equanimity and trying to see clearly the patterns that get us caught in grasping, and the other person really wants a story indulged, right, or a particular kind of aesthetic created, that's hard. Right? If one person really wants to process things and the other person just wants to la la la, everything's okay if we don't talk about it. That's hard. So it's very nice to get your partner into the Dharma. I sort of lucked out. I started dating someone who didn't have a Dharma practice, but who had clearly a deep spiritual practice, who had done Native American practice and devotional practice in other ways. And I kind of just crossed my fingers. And for the first couple of years, she was like, what is this thing you do? We'd been together for about 7 months when it came time for me to do my annual 2-month silent retreat that for a while there I had been doing every year. And just because we got together didn't mean I was going to stop doing that, right? So it's, you know, so it's like December, and I'm like, okay, I've put in my deposit. I'm going to go away for all of February and March. And that means I'm not going to call. I'm not going to text. There was no texting yet. But I'm not going to call, I'll see you on the other side, like, have a wonderful... And she was like, what are you talking about? We just got together. We're having a romance. You can't just leave for 2 months. And I was like, no, this is really important to me. And she was like, okay. And for a couple of years, we did that. And I was just like, we'll see how this goes. And eventually, she did a retreat. And she came out and she was like, oh, cool. And I was like, yeah. And it was like, look, right? Because it might have gone another way. And she's now a really profound and beautiful teacher if you get a chance to hang out with her at all. But love. This is an incredible passage that doesn't get taught on much, where the Buddha is talking to someone who can't seem to get anywhere in practice. This monk, his mind isn't getting calmer, his heart isn't opening, he's not getting anywhere, classically speaking. And the Buddha says, it's okay. He said, like, what's strongest in your practice? And the monk essentially says, like, kind of nothing, but I'm here. I'm just trying. And the Buddha understands in a certain way that what this monk has is devotion. And the Buddha gives a teaching where he says, it's good if you can practice to the point of liberation. And if you can't do that, it's good if you can just be solidly on the path toward liberation. And if you can't do that, it's really good to just like devotedly keep the basic building blocks of practice, generosity and the precepts and the steady gathering of the mind. But if you can't do any of that, and then this teaching is actually repeated almost verbatim in the Bhagavad Gita 700 years later in a different tradition. If you can't do any of that, just love me. The Buddha says, just fall in love with me, your teacher. I'm not saying this to you. This is the Buddha saying it to you, just so you know. And that'll be enough. And then the Buddha says a very interesting thing. He says, the practitioner who does that, they will go to heaven. Not liberated, it won't liberate you yet, but after death, you can go to one of the glorified planes that are connected to the feeling of love. And from there, your heart will purify more and more, and you'll return to a plane of deeper practice, and you'll continue. You will eventually find liberation. The Buddha rarely suggests practices that don't lead to liberation directly, to monastics. This is one of those times, and the thing he suggests is that the practitioner fall in love with him. Again, we could say not romantically in a certain way, but devotionally. And there's a kind of devotion that starts to emerge here, and in the Bhagavad Gita and the later bhakti yoga traditions, flowers in an incredible way. Where Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, those who meditate and revere the formless, they will reach me in the end. But their path is slow and arduous because the formless is difficult to fall in love with. It's difficult to focus on, right? It's much easier to focus on a thing than it is to focus on nothingness. Krishna says, if you can't become liberated through seeing clearly, practice concentration. If you can't concentrate, just devote your actions to me. If you can't even do that with any consistency, he's like, you're a mess. But he says, just love me. Just love God. Just love this personification of God. And that's enough. That'll take you there. And in a way, the devotional traditions are the closest many religions have to a full-throated celebration of, I think, a similar quality to the force in the heart that we use in the romantic love process. That it's possible to fall in love with God in the way that we fall in love with a human. And the results of falling in love with God or with reality or with truth, using our, almost like, and this is a very tantric thing to say, almost like transmuting the romantic impulse into a religious or spiritual impulse, is the almost one of the easiest and most powerful paths that we can take. A friend of mine was in a period of deep devotional unfolding, and she said one thing she would do, she was about my age, which is 46 right now, she would turn on the radio to like a top 40 station, and she would just listen to, or like an oldies station, oldies top 40, And she would listen to all the great, like, love songs from the 80s. Cheese songs, like really oof songs, right? And she would just sing along with them, and she would just make the object of the song God, right? You know, and they will never, ever, ever tear us apart, right? Like, and you just take that and you turn it toward the divine or toward nature or toward the truth of things as they are, and that becomes a powerful force to keep you on the path, to unfold the path. The beautiful 15th century Rajput saint, Princess Mirabai, writes about the process of awakening, the spiritual process, through the lens of romantic sensual connection. And her object of devotion is Krishna, who she calls the Dark One, or the Lifter of Mountains. The Dark One is Sham. The Lifter of Mountains is Giridhara. And she says, and the arc of the journey here in a certain way is the operatic arc of meeting and sexual union and then loss and separation and longing and wanting and then reunion. And so she says, all I was doing was waiting. And the dancing energy came by my house. Right? We have a first contact with God, truth, reality, selflessness, our true self, whatever we met. And it transfixes the heart. We fall in love with it. You go on meditation retreat. My sweetheart went on meditation retreat, and she came out saying, oh, I met something there that never came to me in any of my other practices. I want more of that. If you've come here several times, you've had any taste of that. If you've come to any spiritual practice several times, you've had a taste of that. You want more. If you keep practicing, God bless you, or Buddha, or whoever, you will lose that contact. So what happens? Krishna leaves. And Mirabai says, you faithless one, dark one. You came and ravished me in the night, and now you're gone, playing with other women. You've left me, like, broken. I stand at the door all night, staring at the road. As we practice, inevitably we lose contact with that which we love, whether in relationship or in divine relationship. And our practice is to stay present, to stay in. Right? This is a metaphor for commitment. If she gives up then, and it's just like, fine, whatever, I'll just go marry some guy and like go back to business school. She loses the thread in a certain way. She has to actually stay awake staring at the road. That's practice, right? You meditate, it feels blissful. Oh my God, my energy's rising. My body is like a blissful, like a soft orgasm of divine presence. I'm like, welcome to meditation. We want your early meditation experiences to be like that, because in a few days or weeks or months or years, you're going to be like, it's not happening. Actually, all I feel is my despair, my heaviness, the thickness in my heart. And I haven't felt that bliss in days, weeks, months. The only instruction during that point is not to give up faith. It's to stay in. Sometimes it's called the rolling up the mat phase. Right? I've been through it countless times. Almost every retreat I have periods that go through that. It's just like, fuck it. I can't do it. I suck as a meditator. I'm not getting anywhere. It doesn't feel good. It hasn't felt good for years. Which is never actually true, but it feels like that in the moment. I'm out of here. If you have a good teacher and you actually come to them and tell them that, the thing they need to tell you is, this too is real, get back in the hall. And you're like, I don't want, and they're like, go. And you just stay in, and you stay, you keep coming back to your cushion every day, every other, whatever your system is. Regularity helps. And we mature through it. through the dark night of the soul, through the barren period in a relationship, if we stay in. And you have to have faith, and you have to feel like it's a good place to be, so that's a whole conversation about refuge and about choosing a good person to do this practice with. Of course, if you're with the wrong person, leave. Easier said than done, in some cases. But if you're with the wrong practice, leave. Easier said than done in some cases. But if you know the practice or the person is solid, the faith is to stay in, move through, keep showing up, even though it's painful. And the third phase is this return. And Mirabai writes, "My beloved has returned with the rains, and the fire of my longing is quenched, is cooled." There's this return of contact. And so there's this turning that appears in Buddhism as well, where longing and attachment can turn into a mechanism or a motor for staying in and staying committed on the path, opening, using the fires of the heart as part of practice, not just as something to see as attachment and let go. So, almost no one in Western Buddhism nowadays says renunciation is great. But I'll just finish up by saying, every once in a while, one of you, one of us, says enough with the game of chasing. And that enough, if it's real in you, if it's deep and comes back maybe again and again, or it shows up so deeply that you can't forget it, that is the turning that traditionally sends you toward other ways of living. And there is that way of living. You can join a community of folks practicing and living very deeply together and let go of the game of chasing, of winning and losing. No one anymore says, go be a monk or a nun. Get thee to a nunnery, Ophelia. He didn't really mean it. He was just mad at her. But she can, if she wants to, go there and be free of the game. She might have ended up happier and not in the pond had she done so. So thanks so much. And any thoughts or feelings of yours? Responses, reflections on love? Love is great. And please.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was really reflecting and allowing to surface some theories and perspectives by John Wellwood, mm-hmm. another scholar and Buddhist psychologist. And in his book, it's called Perfect Love, Imperfect Relationships. And he mentions that
well said.
Impersonal love.
Yeah.
And that there is this perfect union, this Atman inside of us, this light, this divinity that we can recognize in ourselves and also in other people. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of problems in our interpersonal relationships are when we expect that personal love to be perfect,
yeah.
which inevitably will bear suffering.
Yeah.
And that if we can just be a bit human with the non-attached energy transmission and flow, mm-hmm. that there can be some solace and peace in this non-attached yet loving and yeah. devoted act of being with each other.
Yeah.
And whether with its family or partnerships, something like that really resonated with me.
Absolutely, yeah. And it should. Thank you for bringing it in. It's a beautiful teaching. Wellwood is a lovely teacher. And, you know, it's a practice. Like, it's easier said than done to be that generous of heart and let go as much as that requires, right? Part of what it requires is feeling safe with the person we're with, right? Or the system that we're in. And so, you know, that's very much what I'm speaking to, kind of alluding to or speaking toward. And It's one of the reasons why it feels to me like it's really a blessing if you find yourself with someone who is open to moving toward that also. Because again, it's difficult if one person has that as their ideal and the other person has something else as their ideal. It doesn't matter if each person falls short in their ideal, but it's beautiful to share some degree of view around that. And then you're both practicing together. It's beautiful. There's a Zen saying about, it's often quoted at Zen weddings, marriage for practitioners is two practitioners under one robe. You become kind of one practitioner working on grace or working on your practice together. You know, and that's very powerful. It's beautiful. Other thoughts? I hope it wasn't demoralizing to any true romantics here. Right?
I guess what's coming up for me is how, like, the romantic love, like, of my relationship is kind of like the most challenging thing right now, and to come at it with, like, I mean, it sounds cold, but I'm gonna say, like, to kind of to attempt to be objective in it is, like, helpful, but also the most challenging.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. What does objective mean, kind of in practice for you?
To, like, observe and kind of suss out what is his and what is mine in our interaction.
Yeah.
And how we can best help each other with what is occurring. Mm-hmm. And what I have, what my ability is and what his ability is.
Yeah. Beautiful, totally. This speaks to an aspect of this that I think is really central for a lot of us in relationship in a certain way, weaves through the whole process, is this kind of oscillation between union and differentiation. Right? We come together, but we're actually separate people. You know, we merge some aspects of ourselves, but then we get too entangled. We have to figure out what actually is mine, what actually is theirs. And the whole dance, in a certain way, is a dance between when is it right to merge and when is it right to separate. And that's, again, a very tantric perspective that, like, in a way, merging and separating is everything. Like, that is what the cosmos is. That is what God does. That's what Shiva Shakti or expansion contraction is that. Like, oh, here's where we're merged. Here's where we separate. And just to be clear about that, right, to not be confused in that process. Maybe so much of our suffering in relationship is thinking that things should be merged that actually are separate or should be separate, or thinking that things should be separate that are actually should be merged. Like, just being confused about that dynamic. Right. Yeah. Good luck.
Thanks.
Yeah, totally. Totally. You're not alone.
Isn't going anywhere in particular, but some of what you're saying is making me reflect on how a lot of the stimulation of romance is the drama and the uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, I think, be really a big charge and the hope for something working out well. But in the long run, not very sustainable. And the couples I see that do sustain that excitement, it's often because they're always getting in fights and getting back together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there are, I think, other models that are more, I don't know, that lend themselves to a fuller life, I think, in a deeper sense.
Right. They make some movies about those people. But do you actually want your life to be like that movie? Okay. I remember at some point when I was single and wanting not to be and in that dynamic, thinking, what if I was just in one of those cultures where, like, I got to be a certain age and my parents were like, we found you a girl, and she's... this is her, and she comes with this, you know, bit of property, and she doesn't know you, and you don't know her, but as parents, we've agreed it's a good idea, so it's happening. And, like, I had no say and no worry in a certain way about it. I'm projecting on that system a kind of satisfaction that many people in it don't have. But it occurred to me, like, what if I could dispense with the sort of romantic search aspect of partnership and just... kind of be set up with someone in a way where the partnership was more, had a different tone to it in a certain way. And I don't know, I've known since, of course, I know people in those kinds of marriages or from those cultures who describe, you know, of course, as we do, varying success with it. Some being like, I love this, this is great, it's totally not stressful. Other people being like, I hate this, I had to run away from home, I left my country to marry the person I wanted. I knew someone who emigrated from India to Canada to get married to somebody who her parents were not into, you know. So it's complicated, but I had the feeling of, like, this doesn't have to be the only story, this kind of drama, you know.
And then the valuing of that drama above any other kind of love.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that drama makes your relationship on a pinnacle because it's what they write stories about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How many of us are tormented by a concept called the one? Right. As if there's only one person on the planet who happens to be roughly about your same age and social class availability who you could get together with, and every single other person of the 8 billion is not that. Right? Maybe it's true, but maybe it's absurd.
I read recently that they ran the numbers and it would be virtually impossible.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. I'm so glad someone runs numbers on these things, you know? We are a data society. Yeah. Yeah. There's something heartbreaking about living inside a system that teaches everybody to want something that it's statistically impossible for everyone to get. Mm. Now, of course, that's capitalism. And now we're talking about capitalism and patriarchy in the context of romance, right? Attain the best product called partner. And, you know, no matter how many people you have to, you know, kick in the face to do so, you do it, right? They will never, ever tear us apart. Who's this they that's tearing people apart? Right. Any other thoughts before we close? Thoughts, feelings before we send you back to your lovers or longing for lovers or contented celibacy or whatever you're in? Please.
Don't even know if this is going to come out well, but it's more about, like, not necessarily being in partnership with somebody, but having people in your life who, like, come back to haunt you, like, You know, I'm sure there's a whole, like, kind of way of thinking about it, about, like, longing about those people, but this week I kind of had somebody who had ghosted on me, like, kind of come back from the dead, right when I had let go of them.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know if there's any kind of, like, teaching surrounding that process. But that's just something that I've been thinking about, like,
right,
how that all balances out.
Yeah, I hear zombies need to be shot in the head. Is that true?
Yeah.
To make them stop coming.
In a non-violent way.
In a non-violent sort of. Well, they're already dead, so you can't kill them if they're already dead, right? I think that's part of what the lure of those movies is. It's like, it's okay to do this sort of unspeakably violent thing because they're already dead. It's sort of, it's a weird excuse. Yeah, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of layers of that, right? Like, some are like, you know, this person kind of came back to haunt me in a way that you're just working with kind of your own heart, and you're like, am I clear about being done? Am I not clear about being done? And then there's others that are like, oh, is it time for a restraining order? Like, there's that kind of haunting that is real. It doesn't sound like it's that you're talking about.
Not quite.
But maybe all I know about that, I don't know maybe perhaps much about that, but the teachings on clarity come up as this way almost to say that really central to our practice is to learn how to be more and more clear about what's actually happening moment to moment, both in ourselves and in the situation. So to read other people as well, and to be like, oh, this is a clean connection, or this is a connection that's really sticky. This is a connection where I want something that is imbalanced. This is a connection where the other person seems to want something that's imbalanced. And just, it's almost like mindfulness and observation and a little bit of this kind of objective witness or detachment can teach us to see these motivating forces, especially in ourselves, that otherwise we would just be acting on habitually. So the way that, like, oh, I go back again and again to these kind of unhealthy situations, practice would say, slow down in my actions and actually say, what am I experiencing that is giving rise to this action, you know? Oh, I'm about to call this sticky person. Stop. And the practice doesn't say, don't call them, as if that's an absolute. It just says, stop and feel what's going on. It's like, oh, I'm still hungry for a certain kind of approval, even though there's a kind of toxic hook in it, right? And if I dig deeper, I could be like, oh, because that's what my mom needed for me. So whatever, you can go therapy story on it. But really the practice is just to feel it and be like, oh, that. And then to be like, do I want to do that? Is there a healthier choice to make? And as we get good at that, I think we can decode, or not decode, but, you know, we can kind of unpack what might be like confusing bundles of feelings into a like, oh, here's where I am, right? And hopefully this leads to things like good boundaries and, you know, clear no and clear yes and a decrease in the drama of things, you know. And maybe as the drama decreases, there's a possibility for something else, right? This kind of less hooked love, you know, that we talk about. So good luck as well, you know, and to all of us. Was that Edward R. Murrow, good night and good luck? Which he said in dangerous political times. You could start saying at the end of satsang now. Again, good night and good luck. So good night and good luck. Happy Valentine's Day, whatever that means to you. May there be love in your life. in all of its ways, and liberation. So your donations to support this group are gratefully appreciated and deeply supportive of continuing in this way, offering something outside of the, slightly outside of the realm of rapacious capitalism, and your offering gets split in half between the studio and myself, and it goes in the basket over there. Folks who are new, welcome, and you're welcome anytime, of course. I'm now done with a bunch of traveling, and I'm here for the next foreseeable chunk, so onward. If you ever want recordings from these satsangs and past ones, there's now a bunch up on my website that you can listen to, old stuff, and keep in touch. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's one piece of chocolate left.